Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
All right. We are in an interesting point in our look at John. But before I get into our story for this morning, I want to ask you, have any of you heard of the Great Stork Derby? Anyone? All right. Have you really, Bill? Oh. All right. I was counting on probably nobody hearing of this, but it's a bizarre story, and it's totally true, okay? There's this guy named Charles Vance Miller. He lived from 1853 to 1926 in Toronto, Canada. And he was a pretty successful lawyer, but he was really good at investing his money. So he's like filthy rich, okay? There's not a whole lot that we know about him except that he was never married. And he loved to play practical jokes and pranks. It's kind of funny you put April Fool's up there because he loved to play jokes on people. And he had this little side hobby, almost an obsession really, of studying human behavior, especially when it came to greed. So one of his favorite pranks was to take a dollar bill, which back then was worth a lot of money, okay, and he would put it on the sidewalk and then hide around the corner, and he just loved to watch people and see what their expressions were, what they would do when they saw that dollar bill on the sidewalk. Now, when he passed away, his lawyers had quite the time with his will because every single one of his bequests was a prank. For example, he gave lifetime use of his vacation home in Jamaica to three lawyers who despised each other. And they had to figure out how to share this home. He also picked seven Protestant ministers in Toronto who were well known for being pro-temperance. And he gave them $700,000 worth of stock in O'Keefe Brewery. And by the way, started by an Irish Catholic. And they could not have access to this. They couldn't get the stocks unless they agreed in participating in the management of the brewery, and they had to draw from the dividends. Yep, this is true, okay? Now, the final bequest of his will involved the largest chunk of his estate, and what he wanted to have done was to take the balance of his estate and convert it to cash, all cash. 10 years after he passed away, after he died, it was to be converted to cash, and then the whole chunk would be given to the Toronto woman who gave birth to the most number of children in those 10 years. True. So, and if there was a tie, then it would be split among them. And so this is what became known as the Great Stork Derby. Make sense now? Yeah. Okay, well, 11 families came forward to participate in this baby race. And out of the 11, four moms made it to the end. They were winners. And they had nine children. Nine children in 10 years. And so the money was split, and they each received $100,000, which today would be worth $1.8 million. Would you have done it?
No.
Yeah, the men, of course, they know. I definitely would not have. I would not. There's just no way. I think. I'm not sure how big my greed is. But so Miller became pretty famous for his will. And there's even a movie about it. If you want to look it up, it's called The Great Stork Derby. But, you know, it's kind of a It's a strange legacy to leave behind. Would you agree with me on that one? Yeah. Well, our story today is about greed, and it's about legacy. We've been exploring who Jesus was in the book of John, the Gospel of John, which in which we have looked at how he interacted with people who are in the margins. And we're at this crucial turning point now in the gospel. So far, John has covered about 3 years of Jesus' public ministry. And it's been pretty intense in this struggle between belief and unbelief. There's been a lot of resistance and hostility to Jesus. And now John is about to transition to the final days of Jesus' life and his private ministry. Rather than being public, the focus is on his private ministry to his followers. A big chunk of that second half of John are his final words to his disciples, and we could call them, those words, his final will and testament. He lays out how he wants his disciples to carry on his legacy. So this transition takes place in chapter 12, which is where we're at this morning. And there he tells one more story about Mary of Bethany. Remember Mary being the sister of Martha and Lazarus. And last week we just talked about or covered the raising of Lazarus from the dead in chapter 11. I invite you, if you want to go ahead and turn to your Bibles, if you brought your Bibles, or turn in your apps to chapter 12. But I want to just explain that John tells Mary's story with some intentional framing. What I mean by framing is a technical literary device in biblical studies that's called an inclusio. Inclusio. And it involves repeating either a word, a phrase, or some kind of theme at the beginning and at the end of a section, with the main focus being located in between the repeated material. Sometimes for fun, I like to call inclusios hamburgers. You've got the bun on the top and the bun on the bottom, and the real juicy part is in the middle. And if you read your Bibles and understand this literary device, you'll see these hamburgers being served all over the place. They're there. Another way you can picture an inclusio is two bookends holding up one book in between them. And John bookends Mary's story with a glimpse into what's happening behind the scenes after Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead. Now, Kurt last week read bookend number one, but I want to go ahead and reread some of the verses from that section to remind you of what happened. So chapter 11, verses 45 to 57 is the front end of the story. So I'm going to start there, verse 45. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Now, let me stop here for a second and mention the fact that John gives us a clue that he is setting up Mary as the main character. Did you notice that he only mentioned the Jews coming to see Mary? It's kind of weird that he doesn't even mention the friends of Lazarus and Martha. Okay? But Mary's the focus, and John lets us know that not just Jesus was betrayed, but so was Mary. Verse 47. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Here we have the greed of the religious leaders exposed. And because of their greed for power, they totally miss God. I love this recent tweet from Mark Charles, a Navajo activist. He posted recently, "If I'm reading my Bible correctly, the gospel tends to be good news to the poor, disruptive to the status quo, offensive to the rich, and terrifying to those in power." It was true then, it's true today. So let's keep reading verse 49. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. "You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish." And then let's skip down to verse 53. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. And then the chapter 11 closes with verse 57. Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, where Jesus was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him. So Lazarus's resurrection was the final straw for the religious leaders, and they are out to get Jesus. So next comes Mary's story, which is the main focus. But before we read it and unpack it, I want to go ahead and jump ahead to bookend number two. chapter 12, verses 9 through 11. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well, for on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. So when you compare the two bookends, the repeating elements are pretty obvious. You've got the reference to the miracle of Lazarus, and then a lot of the Jews that end up believing in Jesus because of that miracle. And finally, there's the response of the religious leaders who are afraid that they're going to lose their power and their status, and so they want to kill not just Jesus, but also Lazarus. So the consequences of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, they're huge. The air is just so thick with tension, this tension between hatred and fear, between unbelief and belief. And right in the middle of this tension is this story that feels so out of place because it's full of tenderness and innocence. It's no accident that John frames Mary's story this way. It's a story of contrasts. So let's go back now to the beginning of chapter 12 and read Mary's story, verses 1 through 8. And that's the book being held up by the bookends. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus said. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. One of the reasons I wanted to explain the inclusio was to show you that Mary's act of pouring that perfume is very closely tied to what happened to her brother. To understand what she may have been feeling, you have to understand how traumatic it was for her and Martha to lose Lazarus and then to have him restored to them. These were single women in a patriarchal culture, and their security and status were derived from husbands and children. Mary and Martha had neither. Lazarus was it. He was their male benefactor, and losing him would have been disastrous for the women. So that bottle of perfume was more than just a precious item. Being worth a year's wages, it was actually future security for Mary. I have a little exercise for you. I want you to think for a moment what a year's wages would look like for you. What does it mean to you? I want you to have that dollar figure in your mind, okay? What does a year's wages look like? How much? Let's say before taxes are taken out. Now imagine a bottle of perfume that's worth that same amount, and you're about to pour the whole thing on someone's body. How does that feel? Oh, I'd be thinking twice about that one for sure. Yeah, there would have to have been a lot of emotion and conviction behind that decision, right? To match the value of that perfume. At the very least, Mary's act was probably being driven by gratefulness for what Jesus had done for their family. She knew what it cost for Jesus to come to Bethany. Bethany is only just a couple miles east of Jerusalem. She knew that the Pharisees were looking for Jesus. They had even tried to stone him twice. For Jesus to come anywhere close to Jerusalem would put him in physical danger. And even his disciples expected to die with him if he came to Bethany. So Jesus coming to their town was a sacrificial move. But to the disciples, Jesus' decision seemed reckless. And so did Mary's decision to pour out all that precious perfume, even on Jesus. It seemed reckless. Impulsive, irresponsible, but not to Jesus. Most of the commentaries on this story describe her as expressing extravagant love. Extravagant love. Extravagant because of the value of the perfume. But to Mary, it was a response that matched the love Jesus had already shown to her. Extravagant, reckless, sacrificial love. The cost of that perfume was nothing compared to what Jesus had done for her, who he was to her. Pouring it was an act of gratefulness, an act of worship, of love and devotion, an act to honor Jesus and to communicate her trust in him. Maybe even an act of repentance for having rebuked Jesus when he was late to the funeral. You know, kneeling to pour the perfume on Jesus' feet and then wipe it with her hair, this was a really important detail for John to tell us. In fact, if you go to Matthew 26, where you hear his version of this same story, there's no mention of feet. Matthew says that Mary poured the perfume on his head. I think John has another reason for telling the story the way he did, for adding that detail. He wants us to see Mary's act as anticipation for something that Jesus is going to do later for his disciples. As John tells his stories, he has this habit of kind of giving you a preview of what's up ahead. If you remember from last week from chapter 11, when John tells us about the fact that Lazarus is really sick and he introduces Mary as the one who pours perfume on Jesus, you know, it hasn't even happened yet. And so that would be kind of confusing to readers who haven't read up ahead, right? And then in our story, he tells us about Judas and says he's the one that's going to betray Jesus. In telling us about how she poured that perfume on his feet, it's not so much a preview this time as much as it is connection, because it's a similar act. Chapter 13 is the beginning of the second half of the gospel, and that second half focuses on the days leading up to and immediately the days after the crucifixion. And the chapter starts, chapter 13 starts with this commentary from John on the meaning of the events that he's about to describe. Let me read verse 1. It was just before the Passover feast, Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Jesus' love is really the framework around everything that's going to be happening in the days ahead. And this is the first event that John tells us about, this evening meal where Jesus gets up, wraps this towel around him, grabs a basin full of water, and then goes and tries to wash the feet of the disciples. This is a really awkward moment for the disciples. It's embarrassing, and it feels dishonoring to them to see their rabbi washing their feet. But Jesus chooses this ritual, this action, to be the first expression of his love as he gets ready to leave the world. So beginning with the foot washing, he shows the full extent of his love all the way to the cross. Mary instinctively did what Jesus is going to demonstrate to his disciples later. Disciples who didn't yet quite understand his extravagant love. But Mary understood. And I am still actually trying to. I want to tell you that this morning I'm feeling still a little bit raw after digging deep into Mary's story. Some of you know that my mother is a deaf mute and that she's illiterate. And because of this, in all my growing up years, I've never really seen her as a mom. My dad was the main parent. And so she and I didn't have a normal mother-daughter relationship. In fact, it was barely a relationship at all. After my dad passed away, she came to live with us, and it's been, hard to believe, 20 years now. And in those 20 years, a relationship has grown, but it's still pretty minimal. It's definitely very complicated, especially as an adult trying to relate to a mother now. And to tell you the truth, I really struggle to love her. A couple of weeks ago, while I was like really deep into the study and I was getting all this and looking at extravagant love, we had a really major fight, a big one, and she wanted to like move out immediately that evening. It was pretty ugly. And all I could think was, I am like the last person to have to preach this message on extravagant love. I realized that I don't even like my mom, and so I felt like a hypocrite. So I'm putting this out in front of you, this confession, because I realized that extravagant love is really easy to talk about, but sometimes it's extremely hard to do. And I can also be open about it because I know my mom will never listen to this podcast. Okay. And I think I'm 99% sure that none of you are going to tattle on me, okay? Because you probably don't know sign language. Anyway, during this crisis, I thought about Mary's example, and so I felt exposed. And like I said, I felt like a hypocrite. But then something hit me hard. About a day after the fight, she asked me to give her a pedicure. And it occurred to me that I may not wash her feet like Jesus did or Mary did, but kneeling on the ground to cut her toenails, I felt like it was close enough. So it doesn't sound very extravagant, but for me, it felt like a step in the right direction. Long after today, I'm planning on sitting with Mary for a while, sitting with her and her bottle of perfume, because I think she's helping me to want to figure out how to love my mom with extravagant love. About her perfume, I want to talk a little bit more about that, okay? You know, from a certain perspective, Judas had a legitimate complaint. That perfume could have been sold and that money given to help the poor. The problem is, his motives are corrupt. John is the only gospel writer that tells us this little detail about Judas, that he's been stealing from the offering plate, that he's not just a traitor, but also a thief. He didn't care anything about the poor, he just wanted the money. And so John knows this, and he wants to contrast Judas's greed with Mary's generosity. But I have to admit that when I looked at Jesus' response to Judas, it really sounded kind of dismissive. You will always have the poor among you. And I kind of struggled with that statement. Like, it felt like he was minimizing the needs of the poor. Except I know that he's on the side of the poor, that he actually came from a poor family himself, that the gospel is good news to the poor. So Jesus is not minimizing this form of injustice, and he's not allowing me an excuse to give up helping the poor. He's just recognizing the constant reality of poverty in our world as a contrast to his own temporal, physical presence. The Word made flesh is not going to be staying flesh for very much longer. So he welcomes Mary's response to his reality, that he's about to face death soon. He welcomes what I want to call her extravagant wastefulness. Now, I'm kind of curious as to how you just reacted to that phrase, extravagant wastefulness. Does it make you feel uncomfortable? Now, I'll be honest too that I borrowed this phrase from a video blog made by Sarah Groves. I don't know if you're familiar, she's a musical artist. And in her blog, she refers to a famous Japanese-American Christian artist who's still alive today. His name is Makoto Fujimura. To create his art, Fujimura spends hours and hours and hours mixing his paint. He uses the powder, really expensive powder, to mix his paint. And he said that to the outsider, it looks extravagant and wasteful. But for him, it's necessary in order for him to create his art to create beauty. And in creating beauty, he finds God. Fujimura contrasts extravagance and wastefulness with how our society has become more and more pragmatic and utilitarian. Time has to be spent in useful, productive activity. You feel guilty if you waste time, if you're doing nothing. We expect a return on our money, and we work really hard to accumulate wealth. Relationships have become more transactional. Sometimes you're not sure if a person really wants to be your friend or if they're just networking. Your energy and investment in people can't be wasted. But transactional and utilitarian values do not characterize God's kingdom. Beauty, grace, unconditional love, generosity do. To me, Mary demonstrates that kind of love, extravagant and wasteful love. Love that might be interpreted as wasteful by those who are greedy, money greedy like Judas, or power greedy like the Pharisees, who justified their utilitarian solution. Remember what Caiaphas said? It is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. But Jesus didn't judge Mary to be wasteful like Judas did. He received her extravagant and wasteful gift as perfect for the occasion. And what was the occasion? His final journey to Jerusalem and certain death. Here we see Mary's extravagance in one other way. You know, when Mary entered that room with her bottle, she willingly entered into Jesus' narrative of death. It took a lot of courage for her to walk into that man cave where a bunch of male disciples were probably getting ready to die as martyrs. I can almost smell the sweat, the fear, and the adrenaline. And that included Lazarus, her brother, who was eating with Jesus and the disciples. He was facing the possibility of dying twice in a short amount of time. It would have been totally understandable for Mary to walk into that room and join them with her fears, but she didn't. She entered with her female body in silence, without any explanation, without any apology. In her own paradoxical space between grief and gratefulness, she poured that perfume on Jesus' feet. And there was so much that John tells us it filled the house. It filled the house. I don't think it's an accident that John wants us to know how strong that fragrance was. He's making a subtle reference and a contrast to the comment that was made back in chapter 11, where Jesus was warned about the smell of her dead brothers, of her brothers, you know, the rotting flesh that would have been in the cave if he opened it. I can also imagine that that fragrance is overwhelming that smell that's in the room. I think it's a beautiful metaphor of love pushing back fear. After she pours the perfume, time seems to just slow down as she carefully and methodically wipes his feet with her hair. Here's a woman who's not afraid to enter the ultimate margin, who's not afraid to touch death. This is a woman who loves with what I want to call extravagant presence. Extravagant presence. Mary is present with her whole being. She's present without trying to fix the problem. She's not there protecting Jesus or trying to soothe the fears of the disciples. She doesn't bulldoze her way in, but she also doesn't hold back herself. She instructs us about the gift of presence, the gift of touch, the gift that says you are loved and your bodily existence matters to me right now and it matters to this world. The gift of presence is powerful, and it's especially powerful in those spaces where we see death, where we touch death, where we're present with those who confront death often. And usually it's with those that are in the margins, like the elderly, the homeless, those that are hungry, like the parents of black children who have to give the talk. You know what I mean by the talk? The one where they have to instruct their children on how to behave when they're threatened so that they'll get home safely. Like our kids who shouldn't have to confront death in the classroom, and yet they do. Mary helps us think about what I want to call a theology of death. You know, a theology of body, like what Hillary McBride talked about when she was here a few weeks ago, a theology of body is incomplete without a theology of death, which is the loss of embodied existence. Or I can put it another way. One falls short of a spirituality of love if a spirituality of death isn't included. A spirituality of death forces us to ask, how far are we willing to go for love? I recently read a book by Caleb Wilde called Confessions of a Funeral Director. And he wrote this: a spirituality of death shows us how death is the mystical unifier that helps us see the delusions of our tribal divisions and stitches us back together. I love that, stitches us back together. Death inspires us to empathy, to embrace. It's the common denominator for all humanity that connects us into one so that when someone outside our tribe dies, if we try, we can feel the pain and respond not in fear, but in love. Now, Wilde reflected on the Bible verse Romans 6:23, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. The wages of sin is death. And then he concluded this about what he calls the death negative narrative. Here, death is no longer a natural part of nature, a way nature makes room for the next generation, but an imposed consequence. In this narrative, our mortals' needs and sin are too often confused one for the other. In this narrative, death is something to be feared, something to be fought against, and something to be hidden, all of which leads to a deeply ingrained mortality shaming and a deeply damaging implication that we will never be enough in this life unless we try to be more than mortal by the grace of God. He goes on to reject mortality shaming, which I see as another form of body shaming, or maybe more accurately, dead body shaming. But he rejects that, and he rejects the death negative narrative. Instead, he adopts what he calls a death positive narrative that isn't afraid of mortality. Because here's the deal. Being inherently mortal doesn't mean we're inherently sinful. Being inherently mortal doesn't mean we're inherently sinful. He also thinks we have a problem with our view of God. There's this picture of God that paints God as having no need, a God who is immortal, who isn't dependent on others, and who can stand alone, unhurt, and untouched by relationships. In a word, God has no vulnerability, or so we think. Wouldn't it be interesting if vulnerability lies at the very core of God? Let me say that again. Wouldn't it be interesting if vulnerability lies at the very core of God? As I thought about what he said and then reflected on Mary's story, it kind of dawned on me that this is a story about vulnerability too. You see, Jesus not only affirmed Mary's expression of love, he submitted to her expression, letting her wash his feet with the perfume and wipe his feet with her hair. Jesus didn't object like Peter did in the later story, when Jesus wanted to wash his feet. Peter said, "Lord, you shall never wash my feet." In fact, Jesus responds to Mary with a kind of trust and vulnerability that you don't see him giving to others. The contrast is kind of subtle, but I think that John hints at it early in his gospel, way back to chapter 2, and I want to read verses 23 through 25. "Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing." And then listen to this. "But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man." This verse is really fascinating, and it's unique because it gives us an insight into Jesus' inner life. He didn't need to be told that people were messed up in their hidden motives. He already knew. And because of that, he didn't entrust himself to them. He didn't let his guard down. He didn't let himself be vulnerable, except to Mary. Jesus entrusts himself to Mary. He submits with vulnerability to her pouring of the perfume, with vulnerability to her caring touch. Her act anticipates a time when he will finally allow himself to be vulnerable, even to the ones who want to kill him. It anticipates the cross where God will be vulnerable to death. Matthew, in his version of the story, makes a statement that actually John leaves out, but I think is a beautiful legacy for Mary. In Matthew 26:13, Jesus makes this statement just after he's rebuked the disciples for shaming Mary. He said this, "I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." That's her legacy. Her legacy is Jesus' legacy, and God invites us to participate in that same legacy with our lives. We have the potential to be a story told alongside the gospel story. I want to tell you about one that's in our church, Emily Crawford. You want to raise your hand, Emily? Yeah. I just love hearing her talk about her involvement with Rahab Sisters. Now, their mission is to offer what they call radical hospitality to marginalized women here in Portland. They offer hospitality without any judgment. There are no strings attached. Now, every time she talks about being with them, Emily's face just lights up. And she talks about how being involved with them has renewed and expanded her faith in God. She is demonstrating extravagant love with extravagant presence and even wastefulness, knowing that most of those women will not or cannot make different choices. I'd like to close with another story of extravagant love. Some of you have heard me mention my sister, Pat, my younger sister. She fought cancer for 10 months. But it didn't end well. She ended up in hospice. And so for 3 weeks, I cared for her dying body. And it was really hard. We had a hard time managing her pain. So to watch the progression of death in this way was brutal. But in the moment of her passing, I had my first experience with seeing death. And I was surprised at how sacred and beautiful it turned out to be. After Pat died, her husband and a close friend of hers and I decided to prepare her body before the undertakers came. Now, this was after we watched this Japanese movie called Departures. Have any of you seen that movie at all? Yeah, just a couple. I might have a showing in my home to see if you'd like to come, because it's incredibly powerful. It won the Oscar for the best foreign film back in 2009. The main character is a cellist, which is why I wanted to watch it, because my husband's a cellist. And he loses his job in the orchestra and is desperate to find work. So he finds a job or takes a job as a professional preparing dead bodies of loved ones. Now, they do it differently in Japan than they do it here, but the preparation is done in a home in front of family members and friends who want to watch this really elaborate ritual. The subtitle of the film is The Gift of Last Memories. It's beautiful and it's quite powerful. So we tried to duplicate it as best we could. And what that meant was we put on her a brand new t-shirt from Hawaii, which was her favorite place to visit. And I think it's so cool we're having a Hawaiian-themed potluck after church today, which is, you didn't know that. But I put on this t-shirt, and then I put in her favorite earrings, and then I did her makeup. And I can't tell you how powerful it was to touch her in this way, to stroke her face with the foundation, to put on the blush on her cheeks, to put the eyeshadow on her lids, and pencil in her eyebrows. It was healing, incredibly healing. My heart was feeling this crushing from the grief, but at the same time, I felt this expanding, like I was touching death, but I was also touching God. This is Mary's story. Mary, who was willing to touch death with extravagant love. Mary, who reveals a vulnerable Jesus who would himself, in a week's time, be vulnerable to death, touch death, and show us the full extent of his love, his extravagant love. We're going to take communion together now, and I can't think of a better story to bring us to the table, to help us come to the table. The Lord's table is a remembrance, but it's also a reenactment of Jesus' death. The bread is his body broken for you. The cup is his blood shed for you. By taking the elements, you enter a mysterious place where you're touching Jesus and death. Coming to the table is an act of vulnerability and an openness to receive extravagant love. So I invite you to come to the table to enter Jesus' narrative of death, his death-positive narrative, where we don't have to be afraid of our mortality.